Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On the NewsHour tonight, New Hampshire voters prepared to make their choice between the only two remaining Republican presidential candidates, Donald Trump and Nikki Haley.
Israeli leaders become increasingly divided over the war with Hamas, the idea of a ceasefire in exchange for hostages, and whether there's any prospect for a two-state solution.
And millions of Americans lose health insurance because of policy changes since the pandemic.
Losing Medicaid coverage, even if it may be for a short period while someone is trying to get re-enrolled, can lead to lapses in care.
Welcome to the NewsHour. There are mere hours to go before New Hampshire voters head to the polls tomorrow morning for the presidential primaries. On the Republican side, former President Trump is seeking a sequel to his runaway victory in the Iowa caucuses.
And President Biden is the prohibitive frontrunner for the Democratic Party's nomination and is expected to win the most votes in New Hampshire, even though his name isn't on the ballot. That's to adhere to a rule by the Democratic National Committee. Political correspondent Lisa Desjardins is in New Hampshire and joins us now. So, Lisa, this is an unusual New Hampshire primary. The Republican race is already down to two candidates, and President Biden's name, as we mentioned, isn't even on the ballot. How are the campaigns seeing it?
This is the first primary of the 2024 presidential election, but the Biden and Trump campaigns hope that it will be essentially the end to the real contest. With Chris Christie dropping out over a week ago and with Ron DeSantis over this weekend dropping out, suspending his campaign, for the Trump campaign, they want to make sure that Nikki Haley does not get any momentum. They want that to end here. For Biden, he wants to stop any potential rebellion even before it has formed. He has challenges of his own making, but essentially what's happening here in New Hampshire is the idea that for both parties, any chance to avoid a Trump rematch has to happen here.
Thank you so much.
She is the last Republican standing against Donald Trump.
That's the sound of a two-person race.
With Ron DeSantis out, former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley faces the test she wanted, a showdown in New Hampshire.
When you vote on Tuesday, you're going to be making a decision. Do you want more of the same?
To growing crowds, Haley pitches Trump as chaotic and herself as constructive about education and the debt, and conservative, including blocking transgender girls from sports. This is her most competitive state, but she stumbled here last month in not naming slavery as the cause of the Civil War. Haley trails Trump and needs voters like Steve Kesslerine, a Trump supporter until his 10-year-old daughter Hannah asked to listen to other candidates. They did, again and again, New Hampshire style. The two became campaign trail celebrities.
8 Nikki Haley events, 3 Chris Christie events I've been to, he's been to 4.
And Steve became a Haley voter.
She talked about how much debt we actually acquired, like the largest debt that of any sitting president. And I started thinking about, like, what do I want to leave for my daughter? What do I want to do for, you know, her future?
What Hannah wants is not Trump.
He's going to call Chris Christie fat pig. He's going to call Nikki a bird brain. I don't want my president to be like that.
But from throngs of Trump voters here,
I'll overlook all of that because he loves America and he takes care of Americans.
There is unmatched fervor and crowd size where he taunts Haley.
Almost every politician from South Carolina is endorsing me.
And where Trump, who faces 91 felony counts, argues he should be immune from most prosecution.
This isn't just me. This is all presidents. They have to be given immunity. Otherwise, they're going to be unable to act.
Many believe Trump's lies about the 2020 election, but others we spoke with shrug that off and say they see a strong man on big issues.
Number one is immigration. I came in this country in the front door, not the back door.
I love the fact that he is taking care of our borders. And he's the only one doing it.
How do you feel other people look at Trump supporters?
That we're fat, that we're delusional, that we're uneducated. Sorry, I've got many degrees, been to 70 countries and speak another language.
It is a potent political force against which Haley has some chance.
This is the first time I met Joe Biden.
thanks to voters like Thalia Flores.
You are a longtime Democrat.
I am a lifelong Democrat, and I've voted for Joe Biden several times.
Her office is a personal museum of primaries past.
Bernie came to New Hampshire.
Walls of photos of Democrats she met. But she's switching this year to vote for Haley, initially to block Trump.
And to be honest with you, that's part of my thought process. Oh, having spent time at all her town halls and events, I grew to admire her.
Meantime, she has lost some faith with the Democratic Party, which stripped New Hampshire of its delegates after the state kept its early primary date, despite Biden and the party ordering that it be moved back.
To say I'm disappointed is an understatement. I'm not going to vote in it because they're not counting my vote.
I'll just head in and pick up the sign.
The primary date debacle ended in the Biden campaign deciding to stay off the ballot and out of the state.
We need to make sure that we put Joe Biden on the top of the ticket.
So now Biden's fate here is partially in the hands of grassroots efforts, one muscular super PAC and a ragtag campaign of volunteers.
Super unusual. No one involved has done anything like this before.
Colin Van Ostern is a former gubernatorial nominee who helped start the effort, first with six people on a Zoom call, and now...
hundreds of people are organizing at this exact moment all across the state in their own communities, and that's a win on its own.
As signs lay out, people must write in Biden's name for him to get their vote.
This is where we're at right now, so let's do what we can to get him in office.
I'm very worried that he's going to have a less than delightful showing, and I think that the Democratic Party has made it harder for him.
Harder for him, but it opens up a small chance, maybe the only chance, for Biden's opponents, like author Marianne Williamson, who's been reaching out to voters here for years.
And we're going to do it.
But none may benefit more than Minnesota Congressman Dean Phillips, who is a long shot, but yet also perhaps the best shot any Democrat has of derailing Biden. The once unknown lawmaker is drawing more people, including a well past capacity weekend crowd.
Are you guys trying to get in? Or?
After a bumpy start, Phillips, a millionaire businessman, now touts his rejection of PAC money and straddles party lines, stressing prudence and reform, including of housing.
I'm going to have the best and brightest Americans, no matter their politics, in the White House.
He is blunt about Biden.
I mean, I don't know how anybody can look at these numbers and determine that he is anything but weak.
It's working with some of the young.
I mean, Obama was a long shot at first, too. I think every campaign has to start with every individual voter.
And with some like this man, who was considering voting for Haley.
If the vote was right now, I would vote for Dean Phillips.
You don't think that's a wasted vote?
I don't, because I personally don't believe in this idea of a wasted vote. I still stick to that, where you should probably end up voting for who you really want to support.
All of this is one question in January about November.
The two most disliked politicians in America, Trump and Biden.
If the U.S. is to veer away from a Trump-Biden rematch, someone else must have a very big night here, like Phillips or Haley.
I'm afraid that on Tuesday, if she does not win here, it is all over at this point.
One more day that could set the direction for the campaign year.
One factor here, of course, are independent or undeclared voters in New Hampshire. Over 40% of registered voters are undeclared. That means they can vote in either the Republican or Democratic primary tomorrow. And by the way, Jeff, as you know, they don't like to be told who's going to win.
So, Lisa, let's start with the Republican side. What does the Haley campaign, what do they say that she needs to do tomorrow night?
Just a few weeks ago, last year, Nikki Haley and her campaign thought they could even pull out a win here in New Hampshire. This is a very favorable state for her. But now, when I talk to them, they're saying they want to have a strong second place. Essentially, the margin matters a lot. She has to prove that she can somehow gain momentum out of this state, especially and try and build something in her own home state, South Carolina, which is next.
And for the Democrats, the fact that President Biden isn't actively contesting New Hampshire, that gives a bit of a window to the long shot candidacies of Marianne Williamson and Dean Phillips. What are you hearing from their campaigns?
All right, there keep being plot twists to our political times. This is an extraordinary situation where President Biden, as I mentioned, has these challenges of his own making by blocking the New Hampshire primary from going first, coming off the ballot. Now, voters have to, who want to actually vote for him, have to look at this. Let's show you the New Hampshire ballot. There you go. Look at this long list of names of people who have qualified for president on this ballot. At the bottom, voters would have to write in Joe Biden. Now, the Secretary of State here in New Hampshire does have some parameters where it doesn't have to be exactly Joe Biden. It essentially, those reading the ballot have to believe that the voter intended to write Joe Biden, could be President Biden, those kinds of things. But there are also challenges not of President Biden and Democrats making. For example, there was a robocall that NBC News got a hold of today in which there was the voice of Joe Biden manipulated to try and tell voters that they shouldn't show up at the poll at all. It's very clear that Republicans would love a situation where Joe Biden underperforms here, maybe gets less than 50%. I will also say, though, Dean Phillips at the same time seems to be getting bigger and bigger crowds. It was really one of the few surprises I had here, seeing overflow crowds for him. And another strange thing in these strange times, maybe not so strange, I've met several voters who are choosing between Nikki Haley and Dean Phillips. What do they all have in common? The big theme here, they don't want it to be a Trump-Biden rematch.
All right, Lisa Desjardins in New Hampshire for us tonight. Lisa, thank you. And be sure to join us tomorrow night for live coverage of the New Hampshire primary. That's at 11 p.m. Eastern, right here on PBS.
In the day's other headlines, Israeli forces blasted their way deeper into Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. Palestinian officials reported ground troops stormed one hospital and arrested medical staffers. Tanks surrounded another hospital. Patients poured into a third site, the Nasser Medical Center, as officials warned the facility is overwhelmed and close to collapse.
With the expansion of ground operations in Khan Yunis, we've received many of the injured. There's no space for them, and the siege on the nearby neighborhoods has made delivery of medical aid difficult. It'll be hard to operate 2 to 3 days out from now with the available resources.
Israel says that Khan Yunis is a hub for Hamas and that hospitals serve as nerve centers for fighters. The White House said today it agrees Hamas is using hospitals as shields, but it said Israel has to protect innocent people just the same. The U.S. and British militaries have carried out fresh airstrikes tonight against Houthi rebels in Yemen. That came after the Iran-backed group claimed it attacked an American military cargo vessel in the Gulf of Aden. The U.S. military denied that. Separately, on Sunday, U.S. authorities called off a search for two Navy SEALs and declared them deceased. They were lost at sea on a mission to confiscate Iranian-made weapons bound for the Houthis. A United Nations report has shed new light on restrictions that Afghan women face under the Taliban. It says access to work, health care, and travel have been curbed for single women and those without a male guardian. The report says that, quote, enforcement measures involving physical violence are especially demeaning and dangerous for Afghan women and girls. In India today, Prime Minister Narendra Modi inaugurated a major Hindu temple built on the ruins of a razed 16th century mosque. It's located in Ayodhya and dedicated to the Hindu god Lord Ram. Today's ceremonies were seen as a political victory for Modi, who's seeking a third term in office. He hailed the event as a symbol of Hindu nationalism.
January 22, 2024 is not a date written on the calendar. It is the dawn of a new era. By breaking the mentality of slavery, a nation is standing up. Deriving strength from the power of the past, this is how new history is created.
Some opposition leaders boycotted the festivities, and Muslims decried the destruction of their temple on the site in 1992. Back in this country, crews in Memphis worked to repair water lines that were badly damaged by days of Arctic cold. More than 600,000 people spent a fourth day under boil water alerts. Frozen and fractured pipes have left the city without clean drinking water since Friday. The cold is also blamed for 75 deaths nationwide this month. The Supreme Court will hear a closely watched appeal this fall from an Oklahoma death row inmate. Richard Glossop was sentenced in 1997 for a murder for hire, but now Oklahoma's Republican Attorney General says he did not receive a fair trial. The court also agreed today to let Border Patrol agents cut razor wire along the Texas-Mexico border. The state installed it along a 30-mile stretch near Eagle Pass. The Biden administration sued to stop it. Today's ruling stands until a final decision in the case. On Wall Street, stocks moved higher ahead of corporate profit reports coming later this week. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 138 points to close above 38,000, a new high. The Nasdaq rose 49 points. The S&P 500 added 10. And two passings of note. Dexter Scott King, the younger son of Martin Luther King Jr., died today of prostate cancer at his home in Malibu, California. He was just 7 years old when his father was assassinated. Later, he became an attorney and chaired the King Center in Atlanta. Dexter Scott King was 62 years old. And acclaimed Hollywood director Norman Jewison died on Saturday. His 1967 film, In the Heat of the Night, about a black detective working with a white racist sheriff, won the Best Picture Oscar. He also directed Fiddler on the Roof and Moonstruck, among many others. Norman Jewison was 97 years old. Still to come on the NewsHour, Tamara Keith and Amy Walter discuss the vice president's new push to highlight abortion rights. Stanford's Tara Vanderveer becomes the winningest coach in college basketball history. A brief but spectacular take on making college accessible for undocumented students, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
It's the last night ahead of the New Hampshire primary, and the Republican presidential field is now a two-person race after Florida Governor Ron DeSantis dropped out over the weekend. Meanwhile, Democrats have to navigate a ballot that will be missing a key name, President Joe Biden. To help bring us up to speed on all of this, I'm joined by our Politics Monday duo. That is Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter and Tamara Keith of NPR, who is in New Hampshire. So, Tam, kick us off here. Days after lamenting about Republicans who were lining up to kiss the ring of Donald Trump, as he put it, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis does exactly that. He drops out of the race and endorses Donald Trump. What does that say to you about his campaign and this race right now?
The DeSantis campaign started with so much promise, but from the moment it actually launched, it was troubled. He launched on X, the social media site formerly known as Twitter. It was a total disaster. It was just a technical disaster. And then from there, his campaign burned through cash. He ended up relying on an outside super PAC that you're not technically supposed to coordinate with. It turns out turfing your campaign to a super PAC may not actually work that well. And he just burned through campaign managers and super PAC heads. And in the end, it was just a failed campaign. But the big failure was finding a message that actually worked with this Republican electorate, because he was saying he was Trump without the baggage. And it turns out a lot of Republican voters, enough Republican voters, just don't care about the baggage.
Amy, it's not like he was out there alone, right? He had a lot of support. He had a lot of money. This is the guy, by the way, the New York Post crowned as the future, or de future, playing on his name. This was after he won big in the midterms. He had a lot of key endorsements, too. What happened?
I think Tam summed it up pretty well, which is that he just never found a message that was going to resonate with an electorate that still really likes Donald Trump. I mean, at the end of the day, there were many problems with this campaign. So Tam is absolutely right. Some of this is tied to him. But a lot of it is about the Republican Party and who Republican voters are. If you get Republican establishment, sort of the elite class, the donor class, they want anybody but Donald Trump as the nominee. That's not what voters want. And that disconnect has been apparent since 2016. And so for all the money and all the effort that a lot of those folks who were dubbing him, DeSantis, giving him money, wanted to believe that this is the formula, this is how you unseat Donald Trump, with a candidate that's a lot more like Donald Trump. The problem, as one Republican strategist said to me early on, is that strategy, that idea of being Trump without the baggage, really what he was Trump light. And for voters who know that they can get the full calorie Trump, they didn't want the diet version.
The full calorie.
Yeah.
Well, Tam, let's talk about what this means for the race now. You're in New Hampshire. It's essentially a two-person Republican race now with Nikki Haley and Donald Trump. We have a new poll from Monmouth, which now shows that while Haley has picked up some support from independents, she hasn't closed the gap. Some 52% of potential Republican primary voters there would choose Mr. Trump. Some 34% would pick Nikki Haley. I should note, this was conducted before DeSantis dropped out. So where do his backers go in New Hampshire?
I think we've talked about this before, but Ron DeSantis is much more of a Trump-like candidate than a Nikki Haley-like candidate. People who support Ron DeSantis didn't necessarily want to stop Trump at all costs. And so many of those voters are just going to go to Trump. DeSantis obviously endorsed him and you know, is rallying behind him. Many of Trump's vanquished rivals are rallying behind him, going back to 2016 and now 2024. His rivals are, you know, up on stage with him, rallying with him at rallies here in the state. So for Nikki Haley, Ron DeSantis dropping out doesn't actually help, though it does give her that two-person race that she has said that she wanted, and it will provide a lot of clarity after tomorrow night about the state of the Republican Party and the appetite for a Trump alternative. That said, this is New Hampshire, and independent voters can vote in the Republican primary. And I have spoken to a lot of left-leaning independent voters who, under any other description, would be Democrats. But they are independents. They're registered independents. And they will be supporting Nikki Haley. Those sorts of voters can't vote in a Republican primary in the states to come.
Amy, can those independents make up the difference for Haley?
Yeah, there just aren't enough of them. And right now, if you do look at the polls, she's doing well among those independent voters, but not as well among the Republican vote. And so where it could help is it could make the margins a little bit smaller, especially, as Tam pointed out, if a bunch of people are coming to vote that pollsters didn't pick up on. Remember in 2008, polls suggested that Barack Obama was easily going to win in New Hampshire. That didn't happen. Hillary Clinton actually won. I don't think that's what we're going to see on Tuesday, that Trump is still ahead. But for Haley, this really is a do-or-die state. I mean, the state, the electorate is tailor-made for her candidacy. To not win here would basically be, I think it would be the beginning of the end of the candidacy.
And Tam, we should mention the incumbent Democratic president's name is being pushed as part of a write-in campaign there. He's not on the ballot because New Hampshire state law says they still go first, even though the DNC changed the rule so South Carolina would go first. So Biden's not on the ballot there. But I do want to talk about the message we're hearing from the Biden administration, which is on Roe v. Wade. Today is the 51st anniversary of that decision. We know it's a central part of their re-election campaign message. Here actually is part of a new ad they just put out on that issue.
I think Donald Trump bears an incredible amount of responsibility for these restrictive laws. We need leaders that will protect our rights and not take them away.
Tam, we should note there are 12 states where abortion is or could be on the ballot this fall. Is this still gonna be as potent a force as the Biden re-election campaign wants it to be at the end of this year?
Well, I can't predict just how potent it will be, but I can tell you how the Biden reelection campaign feels about it. And you can see it. Vice President Harris is launching a multi-state tour where she is going to be talking about reproductive rights. She's starting in Wisconsin, a state where a state Supreme Court race was really decided because voters cared about this issue and because there was a restrictive abortion ban on the books. And tomorrow, the president, the vice president, the first lady, the second gentleman, they will all be rallying in Virginia, another state where abortion wasn't technically on the ballot, but where it was a major issue. So this is clearly going to be a centerpiece of the Biden campaign, but they're going to frame it as a freedom issue and say that it's not just about, you know, one healthcare procedure. It's about freedom. And they're looping it in with other things like gun safety and you know, the big issues of democracy that we've seen Biden talking about already.
Yeah, and I think it was also really interesting in that ad, she makes this connection between Donald Trump, the choices he made, especially putting many of the current justices onto the Supreme Court, and these restrictive laws in states like Texas, where she is from. You know, in 2022, Democrats were very effective in making the individual Republican candidate look out of step, basically just showing what those candidates had said about abortion access. They had very restrictive views on the issue. But it really wasn't about Donald Trump in 2022. It was about those individual candidates. And so what the Biden campaign needs to do is to make that connective tissue between Donald Trump and this issue of freedom and abortion access.
And Donald Trump certainly helped them with that in a recent town hall on Fox News. He once again claimed credit for it. I was at Biden headquarters the day after that, and they were quite pleased to have that video in their arsenal.
All right. Amy Walter and Tamara Keith joining us tonight from New Hampshire. Good to see you both. Thank you so much.
Welcome.
As the war in Gaza nears 4 months since the October 7th Hamas attacks in Israel, the shape of the debate inside that nation has become even starker. Around 130 hostages still held, a world increasingly outraged at the Palestinian death toll, and clear disagreements with Washington, as the Israeli prime minister says he'll stay the course. Nick Schifrin reports.
Israeli politics is always a contact sport. But today, in an Israeli parliament committee meeting, the families of hostages held in Gaza erupted.
I ask you, if these were your children, what would you have done?
Hostage families are increasingly challenging the government, including outside Prime Minister Netanyahu's house. They want to prioritize their loved ones over prosecuting the war in Gaza. That debate is now inside Israel's war cabinet. Gadi Eisenkot is a war cabinet observer and former army chief. In December, his son Gal was killed fighting in Gaza. He promised to make the right decisions for those who have sacrificed. Last week, he criticized Netanyahu and said the best way to release the hostages was a ceasefire.
It is impossible to return the hostages alive in the near future without a deal. And whoever is selling lies to the public, then he's selling lies. There's no other way to put it.
Publicly, Netanyahu has rejected any deal that would require Israel to stop the war and its effort to uncover Hamas tunnels that it says hid hostages, including this one under the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis.
I utterly reject the Hamas monster's capitulation terms. Only total victory will ensure the elimination of Hamas and the return of all our hostages.
But U.S. officials say there are negotiations over a longer pause in exchange for the release of most, if not all, of the hostages.
There are a number of two-state solutions.
There's also a longer-term Netanyahu disagreement with the U.S. On Friday, President Biden reiterated he believed Israel's security would be best guaranteed by a two-state solution.
But BMTS said he's opposed.
No, he didn't say that.
But over the weekend, Netanyahu made clear, at least publicly, that is exactly what he said.
My insistence is what prevented for years the establishment of a Palestinian state, which would impose an existential danger to Israel. As long as I am prime minister, I will continue to firmly stand by it.
It's the president's view that a two-state solution is the best path forward.
Today, National Security Council spokesman John Kirby once again put the onus on Israel.
It's going to require leadership on all sides in the region as well, and it's going to require leadership there.
To discuss the next steps in the war and the debates over the best way to release the hostages and over the two-state solution, we get two views. Retired Brigadier General Yonatan Shimshoni had a 25-year career in the Israel Defense Force. He's now one of the leaders of the group, Commanders for Israeli Security. And retired Major General Gershon HaCohen had a 42-year career in the Israel Defense Force. He's now at the Begin Sadat Center for Strategic Studies at Bar-Ilan University. Thanks very much to you, both of you. Welcome to the NewsHour. Yoni Shimshoni, let me start with you. What is the best way, in your opinion, to get the release of the hostages currently in Gaza?
Okay, well, the best way is clearly not the way that we're trying to do it now, which is guided by some theory of total force, force only, no diplomacy, no political direction. And the more we apply force at the moment, not that we shouldn't have during the first 4 to 6 weeks, it's causing the hostages to wilt and to be in greater jeopardy. So we need to somehow create some kind of deal that will include stepping down, stepping back, or doing whatever it takes to create a deal that will have a political dimension to it to release the hostages.
Gershon HaCohen, do you agree? Do you think Israel should do whatever it takes, quote unquote, to make a deal?
We must fight in order to defeat Hamas, because they actually bringing an existential threat to Israel. It is really an existential warfare, and we cannot focus ourselves only on the other mission to release the hostages. Actually, we are working in both sides with these two efforts simultaneously, not just either or. And yet, the offer that was just put on the table is, in my eyes, a kind of unconditional surrender of Israel. It means a demand of Hamas to stop the war.
Yoni Shimshoni, what about that? The idea that the Israeli government is both pursuing a military option to pressure Hamas, but also being willing to actually pursue this diplomatic path. We know from reports that it is willing or considering a longer pause for the release of hostages.
The more we apply force, they will be in a last stand type of mindset. And if they get into a last stand kind of mindset, they will probably kill all the hostages in the last stand. The other option is that they would be willing to seek a secure exit and of some kind. And in that case, they would use the hostages. And the logic of that situation suggests that we should go for a deal as quickly as we can. And if it requires a diplomatic ceasefire, whatever it is, do it now. Because the logic of this situation says either there's a deal or we lose all the hostages.
Gershon HaCohen, is that right? Could more military pressure, in fact, lead to the death of the hostages?
That is really a danger. Everyone aware about that. We cannot ignore it. But on the other side is the real existence of Israel. We cannot permit ourselves not to defeat Hamas in that occasion. We are not just making pressure upon Hamas in order to release the hostages. We are struggling to defend the Israel existence. This is the main goal of the war.
Yoni Shimshoni, let's look beyond today. Who do you believe should run Gaza after the war ends?
Ultimately, it's a Palestinian environment. It's a Palestinian population. And if anybody's going to lead it, it is going to be a Palestinian polity of one kind or another. And what the world is telling Israel, in no uncertain terms, the world being the United States, Europe, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt, and more, are telling us, yes, it needs to be a Palestinian entity, and it needs to be rolled up in with the Palestinians in the West Bank, i.e. the Palestinian Authority.
Gershon HaCohen, who do you think should run Gaza after the war ends?
Israel could really support Gaza to be a kind of state, and we are expecting, and we have the right to expect, that this state will be in alliances with Israel and not an enemy. Right now, the Palestinian Authority is not in alliances with Israel, far away from that. They are supporting terrorists. We can live with the idea that United States really insisted that Gaza will stay completely under Palestinian hands. Okay, but not with Palestinian Authority. I don't believe in the promise of President Biden that he can change the entity and the character of Palestinian Authority.
Yoni Shimshoni, what about those criticisms, specifically that the Palestinian Authority has incited Palestinians toward violence and is corrupt and is frankly unpopular among Palestinians in the West Bank already?
I agree with the description, but I don't accept a static theory of history. You know, the Germans and the Japanese were the devil, were demons, and Egypt was out to destroy Israel for so many years. I think things can be moved if you inject hope and some kind of future and maintain tremendous power and security control for a long time and require demilitarization for a long time and international oversight. I think things can be moved.
There are some who criticize Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for making decisions based on personal decisions, trying to extend his prime ministership as opposed to national security. What do you think?
We are in a time of war. He's leading our nation in a very complicated war. I don't believe that our soldier will sacrifice their life for that interest of Netanyahu. They are struggling for something much more sublime than a political interest of somehow. So I don't believe in it.
Gershon HaCohen, Yoni Shimshoni, thank you very much to you both.
Thank you
very much.
Medicaid recipients have typically had to prove their eligibility each year to renew their coverage. But that stopped during the onset of the COVID pandemic. And for 3 years, recipients have been continuously enrolled. But that re-enrollment provision ended in April. And since then, more than 15 million people have been disenrolled from Medicaid. We're joined now by Jennifer Tolbert, Deputy Director of the Program on Medicaid and the Uninsured at KFF. Thank you for being with us. So, Jennifer, what accounts for the 15 million disenrollments? Are people forgetting to re-enroll, or is something else at play?
Well, I think it's a combination of factors. So because states kept people on the Medicaid program for 3 years during the pandemic, there are a number of people who have had changes in circumstances. They've gotten new jobs, they've increased their hours at their existing jobs, and because of that increase in income, are no longer eligible. But we also know that there are a lot of people who are losing coverage for what are called procedural or paperwork reasons. And this is a situation in which the state is disenrolling someone even though they don't have information to confirm whether the person is still eligible.
And who is most affected by that? And what about children who are covered by Medicaid? How are they affected?
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of disenrollments among children. I think going into this process, the assumption was because Medicaid eligibility for children is higher than that for adults, that there would be fewer disenrollments among children. But among reporting states, and we only have data from about 23 states, but among those states showing disenrollments broken out by age, children account for nearly 40% of all disenrollments. And so nationally, that translates to about 5 million children losing coverage.
And when people lose coverage, what exactly are they losing? What's at stake here?
Yeah, well, they're losing their access to medical care. And many people on Medicaid are dealing with chronic health conditions or mental health issues for which they need ongoing medication and treatment. And particularly for kids, this can mean losing access to needed medications to control ADHD or to help with, autism or diabetes. And so losing Medicaid coverage, even if it may be for a short period while someone is trying to get re-enrolled, can lead to lapses in care. So people not being able to get needed medications, not being able to see doctors or therapists that can help them control whatever healthcare issue they're dealing with.
You know, looking at the numbers, there is a wide range of disenrollment rates across the country, 61% in Texas to 13% in Maine and Oregon. Why is that?
Yeah, there are a lot of different factors at play here. Some of it has to do with when states started disenrolling people. Some states started earlier than others. So other states have taken greater steps to try and ensure that people who are still eligible remain on the program. So one thing that states are doing, or required to do, in fact, is to conduct what are called ex parte reviews. And this is where state checks available data sources to see if an individual continues to qualify for Medicaid before they send a renewal notice asking someone to complete forms and provide other documentation. States that have higher ex parte renewal rates tend to have lower disenrollment rates because they are able to enroll or renew more people without asking people to take action, which can be burdensome or which can lead to problems like people not receiving notices in the mail or not being able to gather the required documents that the state is requesting.
If someone believes that they've been improperly disenrolled, what can they do?
Yeah, so the best thing to do is to contact the Medicaid agency as quickly as possible. Now, unfortunately, this can be difficult in many states because there are still long wait times for many call centers when people try and get through. But my advice is to stay patient and continue to try and get through to the Medicaid agency. If not that, there are community-based organizations and entities called navigators and enrollment assisters that can provide people with help to complete their renewal process or to challenge if they think they have been improperly disenrolled.
Jennifer Tolbert with KFF, thanks so much for your insights. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
The head coach of the Stanford women's basketball team, Tara Vanderveer, made history last night as she became the winningest coach in college basketball history, surpassing former Duke men's head coach Mike Krzyzewski. Vanderveer has now won 1,203 games in her 45 seasons as a head coach, 38 of them at Stanford. She's won three national championships, most recently in 2021. She's also led the U.S. team to Olympic gold and has been National Coach of the Year five times. More than 30 of her players have gone on to the WNBA. To discuss the impact Vanderveer has had on the game, we are joined now by Christine Brennan of USA Today. Christine, always good to see you. Just give us a sense of how big a moment this is for Coach Vanderveer, but also just for women's basketball.
Well, absolutely, Amna. And because we are now in the absolute pinnacle of women's basketball in terms of interest, talent, of course, Caitlin Clark, LSU, the stories that people know so well, it is absolutely fitting that one of the great people in the game, one of the smartest coaches ever, male or female, a great strategist, self-effacing, someone who would rather read a book than look at anything online, who's not on social media, works out every day, plays bridge. Tara Vanderveer, a legend, a pillar of the game, again, men's and women's. You don't have to have the adjective women's in many ways with her, but the reality is it is women's basketball. She has been leading women throughout the entirety of Title IX as we have watched this wonderful law, 51 and a half years old, working its way through our country and changing women, changing girls' opportunities, women's opportunities. Tara Vanderveer is one of those great historical figures, but she is still among us, she's still coaching. And as you said, it is just a fantastic day for women's sports and for sports in general when we can say that she has passed the great coach Mike Krzyzewski, Duke men's basketball coach, and that maybe there's a couple of people out there who don't want to give a woman her due, but my goodness, the nation has, and it's wonderful to see the acclaim that she is getting for this incredible feat.
You mentioned the self-effacing style. She has really evolved, adapted her game. She's been coaching since she was 24, but her players also describe this calmness about her. Tell us about Vanderveer as a coach, as a leader.
I covered her during the Olympics in 1996, which you referred to, the Olympic gold medal. I've covered her in a couple NCAA tournaments. And of course, again, the important thing here is she won in 1990, the national title. She won in 1992, And then again in 2021. So talk about longevity and the ability to adapt with the game. And I think it is the fact that she takes breaks, she works out, she is all consumed in one way, Amna, as we know, a great coach has to be. But in another way, she disengages and she really wants to have kind of an old school life where she loves to read or just get away from it all. And I think because of that, she has stayed sharp. She stayed fresh. The fact that she still loves it, her players still love her. And she's doing this at Stanford, one of our great academic institutions in the country. Mm-hmm. And think about that. You just can't get any player into Stanford. So she's doing this with the cream of the crop, both athletically and academically, at the most competitive time in the history of the sport.
You mentioned that 1996 Olympic team. That was for me, that was the dream team to watch. They won Olympic gold that had superstars like Lisa Leslie and Cheryl Swoopes and Dawn Staley and Rebecca Lobo on it. The impact of that team and their win and the fan base and the enthusiasm, that is what paved the way for the WNBA to be formed. I mean, talk about the impact Vanderveer has had, not just on the Olympic team, the national team, but on basketball and the actual establishment of a league.
Well, you're right. And that was the Atlanta Games, 1996. A lot of pressure on that team. The Tara Vanderveer took over and actually took a year sabbatical from Stanford to coach that, as you said, that dream team. Because in 1992, the U.S. women had won the bronze medal. They did not win every game. They lost and didn't win the gold. And so, therefore, the pressure's on. Home Olympics in Atlanta. And what was riding on it? Only the future of women's professional basketball. There were actually two leagues that came out of those Olympics in Atlanta in 1996 after Vanderveer's team won the gold. And one of them, of course, exists to this day. It's the WNBA. So the professional opportunities for women, another huge piece of the puzzle of Title IX, those athletic opportunities, you can actually then become a professional athlete and make money as a woman. Those also came out of the victory that Tara Vanderveer's team had.
Just when you look at the game today, Christine, we saw that a new broadcast deal was just announced between the NCAA and ESPN for over $900 million over 8 years. Most of that deal is made up of women's basketball games. What does that say to you about where the game is today?
I think if anyone has watched Caitlin Clark, and we know that she is selling out every arena she goes to, kind of like a latter-day Harlem Globetrotter situation, but it's a woman's basketball player that the nation has fallen in love with. Of course, LSU winning that national title game against Iowa. The TV ratings for that, Amna, were so close to the men's ratings. We have never seen more people watch a woman's basketball college game, and then also, and actually, frankly, college or pro, and then also the fact that it was really just a couple million short of what the men had. And so I think that's where we are, that here we are as we are now the second 50 years of Title IX, and we are watching that the nation has fallen in love with what it has created, the girl next door, the girl you see in the kitchen every morning, and the support now is there. And for years we knew that, as we found out, that March Madness, the title that was given to the men's game, was not being allowed for the women's game to use and market itself. That all changed a few years ago, and now the women are getting their due, and they're getting those big contracts, and we see the fans. It all works and in conjunction with everything else, all these pieces of the puzzle coming together to show us just how much the country has fallen in love with basketball and with women's basketball and these wonderful women stars that we have watched literally grow up in our neighborhoods.
It's a great time for the game, a great time for Coach Vanderveer. Congratulations to her. And Christine Brennan, thank you to you. Always great to talk to you.
You too, Amna. Thank you.
Karen Vallejos is the executive director of the DREAM Project, dedicated to supporting students whose immigration status may pose challenges to their academic aspirations. As a former undocumented student herself, Vallejos says she saw firsthand the barriers that prevent immigrant students from realizing their dreams. Tonight, she shares her brief but spectacular take on dreamers pursuing higher education.
I was 5 years old when my family moved from Bolivia to the United States. Even as a small child, I knew I was undocumented. I didn't really understand the ramifications of that. I knew that because we were undocumented, we couldn't go back to Bolivia. That for me was the worst part of it. I missed my family. It wasn't until high school that I started to realize there was a lot of other ramifications for my status. being undocumented in high school, you really start to feel it when everyone starts preparing for college. At that time, it was 2010, and in Virginia, there was no in-state tuition offered for undocumented students, which meant most tuitions from public schools were twice or three times as much. The DREAM Act was a legislative bill that offered a pathway to citizenship for individuals who were brought here as children. It was something that was introduced much earlier in 2000. By the time it was 2010 and I was in high school, it still had not passed. By then, I had become a very strong advocate, and I was actually on the Senate floor when the DREAM Act was being voted on.
Motion to concur in the House Amendment to the Senate Amendment Number 3 to H.R. 5281, the DREAM Act, signed by 16 senators.
Other DREAMers had come from Texas, from California, from states all across the country, I think. So it was just this massive group of mostly college-age students. Even though we were strangers, everyone was holding hands, and people were counting and kind of whispering and saying, that's 15 votes, that's 35 votes.
Mr. McCain, no. Mr. Inhofe, no. Mr. Cochran, no.
As we kept going, it became very apparent that it was just not going to pass.
The motion is not agreed to.
We were in shock. There's not going to be any legislative relief, and we need to figure out what we're going to do next. It was in that moment that we started really talking about what we could do. Eventually, we, with the support of our families, ended up starting the DREAM Project, which is the nonprofit I am now an executive director of. We thought that we could start a program that would help offer scholarships for students. That was the most immediate need. Our parents would do bake sales, dinners for fundraisers. That first year, the DREAM Project was able to raise enough money and give out 4 scholarships to high school seniors. Since my own graduation, the organization had grown a lot. It was giving out 100 scholarships. It had a formal mentoring program. We even have students now pursuing their PhDs, their master's programs, med school, law school, and you just see the value that giving them a chance when they're young can really bring them. Access to education is important because education is really a great equalizer. Young Americans are headed to college this fall, and thousands will be undocumented. The students we work with all have amazing academic backgrounds, are incredibly involved in their school communities. They're an asset to the American community. My name is Karen Vallejos Corrales, and this is my brief but spectacular take on Dreamers Pursuing Higher Education.
And you can watch more brief but spectacular videos online at pbs.org/newshour/brief.
Well, the new season of the PBS NewsHour Student Reporting Labs podcast, On Our Minds, is underway. Hosted by 2 new teen hosts, Bree Campbell and James Kim, the series focuses on mental health challenges among young people.
On Our Minds is a podcast about the teenage experience, made by teens for teens.
Each season is hosted by 2 teens.
All of us need some kind of space, some kind of person, some kind of environment where we feel like we can reach out to someone else and get help.
This season, we're covering topics such as
defining success,
gender and masculinity,
laws affecting teens,
music and how it boosts our mood,
and more.
Student reporters from around the country produce stories.
Hi, I'm LeBron James.
We talk to psychologists, musicians, and authors to get advice.
Try and stay connected with friends. Listen to what works, not what your brain is telling you works.
Everybody's story can help a person or save a life.
There's a lot on our minds, and talking about it helps.
On Our Minds Season 4 is produced by PBS NewsHour Student Reporting Labs in collaboration with KUOW's Radioactive Youth Media.
Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Season 4 of On Our Minds runs through May with episodes every 2 weeks.
And remember to join us again here tomorrow night when we'll have full coverage of the New Hampshire primary, both here on the NewsHour and in special live coverage starting at 11 p.m. Eastern. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On behalf of the entire NewsHour team, thank you for joining us.